Jill Wolf, 34 years old, March 27th, 2014, Chicago Cultural Center. My relationship is friend and fellow advocate.
I'm Gene Stein, and I am 62. I was born in December 31st, 1951, and I'm here at the Chicago Cultural Center with Jill.
So, Gene, we're here to talk about hepatitis C, which I'm going to refer to as HCV or Hep C. What's your relationship to Hep C?
Well, I acquired it, I believe, perhaps sometime in the late 60s or early 70s. And I was diagnosed with it probably around 1991. And, you know, nothing really happened with it for probably about a 10-year period. But then things began to decline.
What went, did something cause you to get a test, or was it just your doctor happened to do one?
I was applying for a life insurance policy.
And so they take blood?
They take blood, yes.
And that's how you found out?
That's how I found out.
Did you get a letter, or?
They contacted me and told me that there were some irregularities with the test, and they suggested I go have more tests done, which I did, and that revealed that that I had the hepatitis C virus, which at that time was kind of in its beginning, and they really didn't call it hepatitis C. They were still calling it non-A, non-B hepatitis.
And is that what they told you that you had, non-A, non-B?
Yes, yeah.
What else did they tell you when you had it, when you got diagnosed in, you said, 91?
That it could ultimately lead to liver damage and or liver cancer if it was left untreated. And that's...
Had you ever heard of HCV or hepatitis C at that point?
No, had not. I heard of A and B, but no, I wasn't aware of hepatitis C.
So were you scared or just like, oh, this is just something, who knows? Or
I don't believe I was scared, but I was very concerned about it. One of the things that I noticed right off the bat is that my skin was becoming very itchy, particularly around behind my ears and neck. And it was kind of a chronic thing that I'd never experienced before.
And you learned that that was a symptom.
Exactly. Exactly.
Any other symptoms that you had?
At that point, no. There was not much happening at that particular time, early on. But then later on, there were a lot of symptoms.
It sounds like you had symptoms over a period of time, over a long period of time.
Yes, yes. It was a progressive chain of events, I guess you'd call it.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about what you experienced in that chain of events.
Well, like I said, early on, I didn't really have any severe reactions to it other than the itching. I discontinued drinking alcohol and, tried to be very careful about what I was eating.
Did the doctor tell you to stop drinking alcohol?
No, they really didn't. I just assumed that, it was a liver disease, and that was probably the smartest thing to do.
So that was just your own free will.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, are you aware that when we diagnose someone with Hep C, the very first thing we tell them to do is to stop drinking alcohol? That's the very best thing that they can do?
Well, it makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, because, alcohol's tough on your body, and I guess the liver is the first place it begins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was just a decision you decided to make.
That's what I decided to do, yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the process to make that decision? Because, our culture, alcohol, it's legal. Yeah. Many of us, we go to dinner, come home and have a drink, or, two drinks. And it's acceptable. What was, and it's not like your doctor's telling you, Gene, you know, you really got to stop drinking because this is like pouring gasoline on a fire.
Right.
What went into your process? Because there are people probably who want to stop or reduce, or it might have a challenge.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, I'd stopped over, a period of maybe 6 months. I would come home every night and have a couple of beers on a pretty regular basis. So in the beginning, I just cut the weekly drinking out, and I would drink a little bit on the weekend or when I got together with friends or attended a wedding or some sort of event. Mm-hmm. But within a year's time, I believe I totally stopped completely.
And knowing that you would come home, have a few beers, and maybe to help unwind after a long day or whatever your reason was and the reasons that we use, what other kind of coping mechanisms did you put in place? So instead of coming home and having a couple beers, what helped in place of that? Anything? Or what did you do in place of that?
Well, I cook every night. So, I found a little, relaxation in doing that. And, that seemed to work out pretty well. And then I had, other outlets. Like I like to play tennis and I go kayaking and that sort of thing. So I stay physically active. I pretty much have, over the past 20 some years, however long it's been since I first was diagnosed.
It was a conscious decision to stay active?
I don't believe it was. That's just what I've always done.
And what about the preparing and cooking all your meals? Was that, have you always done that, or was that
I've
since?
I've always done that. Okay. Yeah, I've always done that.
Because that's a huge component of having a healthy liver. I mean, everything that we put into our body, whether it be McDonald's or sugar or whatever, is going mm-hmm. through our liver. So, it sounds like you had a pretty good constitution of making some pretty healthy decisions for yourself.
Yeah. I don't know. A lot of that just came easily mm-hmm. to me, I guess you could say. It wasn't a difficult thing to stop drinking alcohol. Occasionally, to this day, I still have a drink mm-hmm. every now and then if it's a wedding or getting together with some friends or. Yeah.
Do you feel the impact, just out of curiosity? Is there any, like, do you feel?
Well, yeah, I do.
You do? How so?
Two beers kind of will give me a hangover the next day. Yeah. Yeah. So as far as physical impact goes, yeah. I feel, it doesn't take much to feel hungover.
So one thing that I know in our culture at large is not only how much people don't know about hepatitis C, but the stigma that is associated with hepatitis C. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about if you've experienced stigma, and if so, how, and has it been in direct relation to living with a virus?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely a stigma attached to it. I don't know if that is still the case today, but I know early on it was a disease that I think the medical community associated with IV drug use or being with prostitutes or just doing having activities that I guess are considered less than moral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also placing blame then on something you've done to, it's your fault that you've done this because you engaged in, the assumption is that you've engaged in X, Y, and
Z. Yes, yeah.
And so how did you experience stigma with that with your doctors? I mean, were they just saw you and assumed something?
Some of them did. Some of them, it was not a non-issue. But I believe there were several who made assumptions about how one would acquire hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm. How about your family and friends who, just like the rest of us, probably don't know much about hepatitis C themselves and have, as maybe family, have had to learn much quicker than maybe friends. But have you experienced any, what I'll just say is stigma from them, or maybe fear?
I'm not so much with my family. I think friends, perhaps friends of the family, they and simply because they don't really understand, what the disease is.
And so how do you handle that? Or how does your wife or daughter handle that?
Well, my daughter tries to explain it to people. I think my wife also does the same. I think she tends to get a little bit more emotionally ticked off about it than myself or my daughter. Mm. But that's where we are with all of that.
Tell me a little bit about that and your wife and what you, from your perspective, maybe a story where she did get kind of pissed off a little bit at someone or defensive and protective of you. And how does she handle, her partner living with this?
Well, she's very educated and she's very bright. So she tries to, or not tries, but she does explain the parameters, I guess, of
the facts.
Dispelling
those myths.
Yeah. And I think I've seen her at times when she becomes a little bit abrasive about it. I think she just becomes frustrated with people's ignorance about the virus.
And what's that like for you, seeing her like that?
It's interesting to see her like that. I guess she does it in a protective sort of way. So,
sweet.
Yeah. But, the biggest problem I see is they're just a great deal of unfounded facts about hepatitis C. I'll tell you, one of the best books I ever read was written by a doctor from Long Island. Her name was Melissa Palmer, and I think it was called Hepatitis C and Liver Disease. That book became my Bible throughout this whole process, and I actually visited her in Long Island, I think, on two or three occasions. She was a workaholic when it came to liver disease, and she would do biopsies on Saturdays in her office. And I understand that she's closed her practice, and I think perhaps she may have just burned herself out. But she was an excellent physician, and I would strongly recommend anybody who's having issues with hepatitis C pick that book up.
And what was the name of the book again?
I believe it's called Hepatitis C and Liver Disease by Dr. Melissa Palmer.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
One of the things that with hepatitis C is it is a silent virus, which means it can go lay dormant, or what we would think, we wouldn't see symptoms, doesn't lay dormant, but you wouldn't necessarily know that you had it. And over time, it progresses. And since each person is different, it progresses differently.
It does.
Talk a little bit about, for you in your case, and how it progressed for you and maybe your unique situation.
Well, let's see. And I was diagnosed in 1991. I probably had the virus perhaps 15 years.
So you were in Vietnam in what years, do you recall?
1969.
Okay.
Yeah. So it took that long, I suppose, before it became visible. And then once it became visible, then it took probably another 10 years or so before it started becoming destructive.
And how was it destructive for you?
Well, my liver enzymes and everything was going higher and higher, and you could I witnessed the progression. I started becoming very tired. That was the biggest problem I had with it. Towards the end, severe. I mean, it was severe to the point where I could be having a telephone conversation and fall asleep.
On the telephone conversation?
Yeah.
And you worked through this? I mean, like you...
Yeah,
were sick.
I worked through it. I worked through it the entire time.
You're a business owner.
Yeah. I mean, I drove. Probably I shouldn't have, but there towards the end it got to the point where I couldn't go 2 or 3 hours without having to take a nap.
So you keep saying towards the end. What's the end?
The end was when my liver began to fail. I was in end stage liver disease, and at that point I was put on a transplant list, and I had to have a liver transplant in 2007. And if I hadn't had the transplant, I would have died.
And you know, the we hear about organ, you know, being an organ donor, and you know, with liver disease, that eventually, you know, for some people it could develop fibrosis to cirrhosis to the point that you experience end stage liver disease.
Yeah.
So you went from fibrosis to cirrhosis and were experiencing end stage liver disease.
Yes.
How, if I were to look at you at that point, would I be able to tell that you were in end stage liver disease?
Yes.
How so?
Yeah, I was yellow. My skin was yellow, my eyes were yellow. My stomach was full of liquid. I had ascites in my stomach and my legs and ankles.
Ankles looked like just big swollen stumps.
Yeah, they were horrible. And my legs felt to walk, it felt like I had weights on my legs all the time.
And so was it at this point that they said you needed to get on the transplant list, or were you, when it became this severe?
I was already on the transplant list at that point. Yeah.
What's it like to be told that you have to get on a transplant list and then get on one? What is that? Must that be like?
Well, I didn't want to do it. The idea just felt really very strange to me of having another human being's organ in my body, and I believe I just had a stigma about that for a long time, and I thought about it a lot, but then I have a great doctor at National Institute of Health, and had a conversation with him, and he said, listen, you're either going to have to do it or you're going to die.
And so was it that the doctor was saying, Gene, get on the transplant list. And you're like, oh, I'm not sure I want to. And then eventually this doctor had this conversation. Or was it once they said, get on the transplant list, you got on the list and then you were like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure I want to do this. I mean, what was the process with, I don't want someone else's organ in me?
Yeah, I think I was kind of saying, that was my view of it before I was listed. But once I became so sick that you know, it was just the only other alternative I had. I mean, I guess I could have, you know, just done nothing, and I maybe would have, well, I would have lasted maybe a few years, because I think it took about 18 months before I received an organ.
So you were on the list for 18 months?
Yeah.
What's that process like? I can't say I have any idea what it would be like. A doctor say, get on a transplant list. I mean, do you have to do something as the patient? Does the doctor, I mean, what's that like?
Well, there's the, what they call the MELD score, where they take your liver counts and your bilirubin, and they, there's a formula, mathematical formula for it. Excuse me. And, they calculate it, and then they come up with a score,
which tells how severe you're
exactly
how sick you are.
Yeah, right.
So
in the beginning, I think I started out, I was perhaps an 8 or something like that, but towards the end, I was about 18 or 19.
And what kind of score do you need to get a
probably
liver
about above 16? I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so here you are, you know, you're 15, let's say. I mean, you're still pretty sick at 15, but you're not sick enough to get someone else's liver,
you know,
is that?
It kind of varies from center to center. I mean, I would think that it does. The doctors know you have an organ that's beyond repair. And, you know, you're just waiting for one to come along to replace it.
What was was death in your thoughts? Was death a conversation that you were having with your wife and your daughter at this time?
You know, I talked about it, but I don't think anybody really wanted to, you know, to believe that that was going to happen. I look back on it and I don't really, I can't say that I was ever afraid that I was going to die, but I think I was just kind of numb, and I just, I was just riding the wave, so to speak.
Do you recall being in a lot of pain?
No, it wasn't painful. The only thing that that was painful was towards the very end when the ascites was pressing against my stomach. And I mean, it was pressing against my lungs, and it became difficult to breathe, and it was extremely uncomfortable.
And so you were on the transplant list for 18 months. You said.
Yeah.
And then you got a transplant. And was this like they call you and like, hey, Gene, good news. We have someone. I mean, do they say it's a 34-year-old woman who lived in Chicago? I mean, how does that work?
No. They call you. And actually, it's an interesting story because I was listed at two centers and I was listed at University of Virginia and Georgetown. And my wife and daughter were in Florida. They were out of town, and I was at home alone. And I don't think they could have gotten back for maybe a couple of days at best. And I got a call from UVA, and they said, well, we have an organ for you. And this was about 10 o'clock at night. They wanted me to drive down there and I said, look, my wife and daughter are out of town. I said, you know, there's a possibility I could die on the operating table. I said, I'm going to have to pass on it. I said, they're not here. They're not going to be here. Even if they were to come by private jet, they probably couldn't have gotten there till late the next day. And I just, I didn't. It was an unknown, and I passed on it.
You made that decision right
there?
Yeah. Wow, I've just got chills. So, did you keep going?
So, I think UVA was not too happy with me, you know, at that point. But and then thereafter, that's when I really started to fall apart. I got a serious GI infection, and I had to be admitted to UVA for 10 days. And then, I don't know if you're familiar, you know, when your liver starts to fail, your blood kind of finds its own pathways. And one of the things that is common in your esophagus, there are a lot of little veins in there, and they tend to blow out, and that causes death with some people. When I was in the hospital for that 10-day period, I was in bed one night, and I was lying there, and all of a sudden, I could feel it pop.
Really?
Yeah, and I had a mouthful of blood.
That's an esophageal bleed?
Yeah, okay. Right, exactly. And I spit it out, and I called the nurses, and everybody came in. But fortunately, it burst, and then it just closed back up. So then I think it was like a day and a half later, they took me in, and they tied those off. It's pretty amazing. I saw the film of it, and they were just expanded, like you can't, like you couldn't believe
it, yeah. It.
And then I saw photographs after the transplant, and they were totally normal.
After the procedure with the varices in your esophagus?
No. After the liver transplant.
After the liver transplant. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of tells you what it can do to your body, yeah, when you don't have a functioning liver.
What did your wife and daughter say after the VA called you at 10 p.m. and said, Mr. Stein, we have a liver for you? And did you make the decision right
them,
there?
Yeah,
you
called them and asked? I called them and told them what had happened. And I said, yeah.
After you told them that you're not going to take it?
Yeah, I said, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, people do die on the operating table. And I just thought, you know, for them not to be there it just wasn't the right thing for me to do.
Do you recall their feelings about that?
You know, I've thought about that quite a bit, and I'm thinking maybe it was the right thing to do. Maybe it wasn't the right liver, because some people have organ rejection. And, you know, I one thing I do know about the organ that I received is that it was a younger man who died of a brain aneurysm, and he's about 11 or 12 years younger than I am. So I've got a younger organ.
So you're really 11 years younger than you are.
In that sense,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take that. We'll take that.
Yeah.
Wow. So I hope this isn't a stupid question, but do you remember going in to get the transplant? And
oh, yeah, I remember. I remember clearly, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I had worked, you know, up until the day of the transplant.
With the swollen legs and the swollen belly and
everything? Yeah, I just kept moving. And because when I sat around, I just felt awful. So I said, well, I'll just try and keep moving. At least it makes it a little better. But again, they called about, it was about 10 o'clock at night. And I told my wife that night, I kind of reached the point where I couldn't drink water. I could barely get anything down to eat. You know, I think that night I had like, the only thing I was able to drink towards the end was ginger ale. Mm. And I drank maybe a half of the ginger ale and a half of a turkey sandwich, and I just felt absolutely horrible. And I told my wife, I said, if I don't get an organ in the next few days, I said, I'm ready to go. I said, I can't live this way anymore. It was that bad. And that night, they called.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just got chills again. So they called and they said?
Said, we have an organ, and get down here as quickly as you can.
This was UVA again?
No, this was Georgetown. My wife drove me to Georgetown. She dropped me off, and I went in, and I was so sick. They were prepping me for surgery that they couldn't find a vein anywhere to put an IV in, and they kept poking me for an hour or so, and finally they went down and got a pediatric nurse. Mm. She came up and found a vein, and they started pumping liquid into me, and then I remember going into the surgery room, and one of the doctors said, we're going to put you to sleep now. And I remember that because it was just such a relief when they did that. It was like heaven. they injected me with whatever they injected me with, and I just passed out. But I was just in so much pain and discomfort. It was horrible.
Do you remember waking up?
Oh, I remember waking up, yeah.
What, were you different?
Yeah, I could tell right away, immediately. I could tell that things had changed. Yeah.
Could you describe a little bit for us?
It was kind of like being awakened from the dead, I suppose. I felt like I had life in me again. They had tubes everywhere. My hands were tied down to the bed. And
why?
So you wouldn't pull anything out of you. And my mouth was just extremely dry, and they wouldn't, give me any kind of liquid except a little water on the end of a little sponge. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I think I stayed that way for, it was probably 2 or 3 days, before I could, do more and more stuff. And I think on the third or fourth day, I got out of bed and walked a little bit. I mean, it felt like I had been hit by a train, but I was moving. And I think on the fourth day, fifth day, I was eating. I was out of the hospital in 7 days.
Is that an average? That sounds kind of quick for a new organ, but is that average?
I thought it was quick, but I think, they want you out of there probably as quickly as they can get you out of there because of the risk of infection, maybe.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had to come back quite a bit after that, about every, 2-3 days.
What would they do when you would come back?
They would run labs every day. They would just, check all the... I still had a couple of tubes in me. It was probably for about a month. I had a... I had to wear like a little... bag and bile wasn't mm-hmm. going, where it into your lower bowel like it's supposed to. It was going into this bag, and then I had to empty it out.
Wow.
Yeah, so that wasn't much fun.
No, I would imagine not.
Yeah.
And, in a lot of what you're talking about, giving your symptoms progressing over time, is that hepatitis C really is a systemic disease. And while it's affecting your liver, it's affecting, your esophagus was,
Sure. It affects a lot. Yeah.
And so knowing that, and you have a liver of someone else that is in your body, and I would imagine you have to take some kind of medication for that.
Yeah, I do. I have to take an anti-rejection drug. Yeah. Which I believe I developed type 2 diabetes from the anti-rejection drug because I was told, in the beginning that that was a good possibility that that could occur.
So and you got it, another, you got a comorbid condition right, now because exactly, you're supporting an 11-year younger liver.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And so this medication that you have to take to make sure your body doesn't reject the liver, that's something you're going to take for the rest of your life?
Yes. Yeah.
And how's your liver today?
Well, it's beginning to show signs of damage from, I believe what they believe is a hepatitis C. Again, It's funny thing. Initially, I had normal liver functions for about the first 60 days.
Post-transplant.
90, yeah, yeah. And then it began to decline a little bit, and we made some adjustments in medications, and then it kind of stabilized. It's never been normal. Okay, it's always been a little bit elevated, but it didn't get out of hand.
And so, just to make sure that we're clear, so the hepatitis C virus lives in your blood and affects your liver.
That's right.
And before you transplanted, you attempted to take medications to get rid of the hepatitis
C
virus.
Did.
They didn't work because you have a difficult to treat type
right,
of hepatitis.
Right.
So then when you got a new liver, the new liver did not have hepatitis C in it. But because there was still virus in your body, once the new liver came into your body, now basically that virus is in that new liver. And so over time, that's going to still progress.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me your thoughts on treatment and today's the day that we're in today in 2014 of the new drugs that are interferon-free. And we didn't talk about your experience with treatment, but knowing that you were on past interferon treatment, how terrible of side effects maybe you experienced. What is your thoughts on enduring treatment now, your hope for it, and what you might think of where your liver is considering it's progressing?
Well, I'm certainly going to go for it. For everything I've read seem to indicate that there have been some pretty amazing results from these new drugs. And they're getting 90-95% cure rates, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely, going to go for that. I don't know, exactly how that's going to work out, but I'm certainly going to pursue it.
Gene, how do you imagine your life will be different? And I'm a optimist. So when you endure a cure?
That's a good question. I don't know really, because I sort of feel that, I don't really know what it's like to feel normal. I mean, I still, have the symptoms of the hepatitis C, I think I've been realizing.